Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest today is Greg Watson. We are here at the conference, the Bioneers Conference, which is a very exciting conference that goes on every year, having to do with living in harmony with the earth and each other, and basically a lot with sustainability. And Greg Watson is a leader in the issue of sustainability. He's from Massachusetts, where he is presently the first program director for Massachusetts Renewable Energy Trust, just recently set up to accelerate the use of cleaner and renewable sources of energy, which is pretty positive. It's always so wonderful these days to hear anything positive. Greg has a background in these issues of sustainability and is the executive director, in fact, of the New Alchemy Institute and the director of the Nature Conservancy's Eastern Regional Office, and it goes on and on. But rather than just telling you all his credentials, of which there are many, we'll just hear about what it is that you are doing, Greg. I know that you worked on a program in Boston in the city, which I think is really important because most people live in cities. I live in a city. Instead of being sustainable, often people think about farmers. They think about being in the country, and we can't all be in the country. So tell us about that for starters.
Yeah, thank you, Sue. Yeah, I think it's true that not even just sustainability. I think when people talk about the environmental movement, they usually don't think of it as something that's relevant to the city. As a matter of fact, I, as a freshman student at Tufts University, way back when, won't go back too far, but was actually criticized by my colleagues in the Afro-American Society about my involvement in the environmental movement back in the 60s and 70s. And I queried, you know, it was actually pretty bad. And I asked them, well, why are you challenging me on this? And they say, well, Greg, listen, slogans of, you know, limited growth, no growth, seems to us that the environmental movement is a ploy to maintain the status quo and has no room for economic equality for African Americans. And it was actually a good challenge. And I must admit, I didn't have an intellectual response at the time, and it's one of the reasons I got involved in the sustainability movement. But it wasn't until I arrived, though, at the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative, and that's a program in greater Boston, a neighborhood, multicultural, Cape Verdean, African-American, Latino, and white, that had been devastated over many years as a result of white flight, disinvestment, redlining, arson for profit, a community that had been literally reduced to rubble as a result of the confluence of all these activities, burned to the ground. So there were about 1,300 vacant lots when the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative finally came into being. And
is this the arson for profit part you're talking
this
about?
This is the arson for profit part. Maybe let me just back up and explain that, because I think it's very important. When you had an immigration and in-migration of a number of people of color into this community that had been predominantly Irish blue-collar working community for many years. People left. They left for the suburbs, and with them left the jobs and a lot of the political clout that had been there when these communities were, again, the white blue-collar neighborhoods. The disinvestment followed because the banks were no longer interested in these communities of color, and that's a pattern we've seen happen time and time again. But there were slumlords who bought up property, and they were waiting for urban renewal. And they felt when urban renewal came in, they'd cash in their bucks and make a huge profit. This community, rather than rolling over, decided that they would halt urban renewal because they knew that if the top-down urban renewal meant that they would be booted out. And when that happened, the slumlords, wanting to minimize their losses, burned the properties to the ground. to collect the insurance. That's interesting. When that happened back there, back in Boston, many of the newspapers reported this as the communities burning down their own homes. And how could this be? What's wrong with them? But literally, it was the slumlords who basically wanted to collect on the insurance, which they did. But the community was reduced again to 1,300 vacant lots. You could stand in the middle of this community in Roxbury, turn around, and not see a building standing. That led to other problems. It meant that it became the site. As dump trucks were on their way to the dumps, they traveled through that community. They took a look around, saw nothing standing, and rather than go to the dump and pay a tipping fee, they began to unload their trash in the neighborhood. It was an incredibly horrific scene that led to health problems as well. This community, as I said, could have turned over at that time, Sue, but what it did was to put a halt to that devastation. And got the mayor. Mayor Ray Flynn at the time had just won a hard-fought election against the first African-American candidate for mayor of Boston back then, Mel King. And in the process of that election, Ray Flynn was an opponent of court-ordered busing, so he didn't have very much political support in the black communities. So the community knew they had some leverage. Ray Flynn promised to help them clean up their community. Resources to help clean up the vacant lots, put fences around the illegal trash transfer stations, and that was the beginning of the cleanup. But here came the biggest point. Then the mayor asked, "Is there anything else I can do to help you?" The community had developed a plan, their own plan for revitalization, which was to create a vibrant, multicultural urban village, affordable, new homes, businesses, open space. They had the plan, but they needed the resources and the leverage to be able to make that plan real, Sue. And so they asked for something that had never been asked for before by any nonprofit community-based organization. They looked at the land. It was abandoned. It was vacant. It was derelict. They had no control over it. They requested to have the power of eminent domain over all vacant parcels of land in their community. Mm-hmm. They would be willing to pay for it, but they said, we need control of this land. Now, this had never, the power of eminent domain is the power that cities and states have to force people off the land. They pay for it, fair market value, but when you see highways, as you know, going through communities and disrupting them, that's when the city or state government can come in and say, for the benefit of the greater good, we can claim this land. And Massachusetts had a real rich history of the power of eminent domain. City of Boston needed water back in the 1920s and running out of water. And it was decided by state government that they would build a reservoir in central Massachusetts. In order to build that reservoir in the valley out in central Massachusetts, four towns were wiped off the face of the earth. The valley was flooded so that Boston could receive water. So the notion of eminent domain usually has very serious and negative connotations for most communities, particularly poor communities and communities of color. So there was a huge debate within the community as to whether or not they wanted to accept this power, because they said, can we handle it? Will it be abused? And this is the beauty of the Dudley Street model. The community pulled together representative government, local government, a board of directors, 30 members of the board of directors elected every 2 years that would be accountable for controlling the land under this power of eminent domain. So they did accept it, and they became the first community nonprofit organization ever to have this power of eminent domain, which is very historic. Now, people say that is probably the most historic and most monumental achievement of the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative. I pause and say the most amazing fact is that they asked for it. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, again, when we start thinking about community building and what options we have for really building community, we've got to sort of look at our full menu of options. What is it that we can do? What tools are at our disposal? And then try to see which ones make the most sense. But you've got to ask for them. You've got, or in many cases, demand them in order to bring about real change. And this community did it. But let me tell you this. When the city granted the community, and again, you know, this is a poor community and the poorest community in greater Boston, the power of eminent domain. Someone asked me, Greg, did they do that because they saw the light? I said, no, they did it because they felt the heat. But when they did that, they fully expected this community to fail. And I'm convinced of this, because if they had granted them the power of eminent domain, if the community had abused that power, failed, then the city would have had every right to come in afterwards, at least in their view, and say, We gave them everything. We even gave them the unprecedented power of eminent domain. And because they couldn't use that to achieve their goals, we all now come in with our plan. And their plan would have been urban renewal. And back then in the 60s and 70s, as Byron Rushing, state legislator, said, that meant Negro removal. And they didn't abuse it. They came up with the plan. They used the power of eminent domain with a $5 million loan from the Ford Foundation as the basis for literally rebuilding their community in the image of a vibrant, multicultural urban village. And I got to tell you, Sue, it worked. 500 new homes have been built, affordable homes, high quality. Every single home, every home that's been built since the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative came into being in 1984 has been approved by the community. The community at community meetings chooses the developer that they want, and when the developer chooses his or her architect, that has to be approved by the Dudley Street community. So every home meets the standards of that community. It is an incredible example of urban revitalization from the bottom up, meeting top down, but under the control of the community.
Absolutely. Well, I remember making up stories like this when I was studying urban planning about what could be, but so seldom do you see it. So that's wonderful. I mean, that's really exciting and thrilling. How many people is this community, more or less?
About 24,000, Sue. And so it's a substantial community. And, you know, it's interesting. It's right in the heart of Boston. I mean, it really, the community, geographically. But it's also the part of Boston, as I said, that's been most neglected. It's on our the public transit line in Boston that takes you to Dudley Street is the Orange Line. If you get any media guide or any the visitor's guide that talks about Boston, you won't see any mention of the Orange Line. Mm-hmm. It's invisible, as you know, as many communities of color are in many of our major cities.
Yeah, and I've certainly heard about Roxbury for many years, and I know that it's, but as you describe it, I mean, you know it better than I do, but it's famous for the things that you're talking about, the difficult things. So that's really impressive to know that that many people are organized to take control of their own community. And I'd like to hear how they're organized a little bit, because that's always a challenge right there, since people tend to not be able to come together smoothly because of their own personal differences, and then there are oftentimes outside influences trying to prevent you from coming together to get any power. So how is this organized?
That's a very good question. And I should also point out the other complication with regard to Dudley Street is the fact that you had sort of the cultural barriers. You had Cape Verdean, Latino, African American, and white culture. So that and with language barriers. Here's the major point to be made here, and the key to the success of Dudley Street was the creation of this shared vision. It's a different organizing strategy. It was an organizing strategy based around a positive vision that everybody bought into. And also, I think there's absolutely no question, Sue, that the fact that they had the leverage, they had access to important assets, the land. I mean, you've got to be able to say, you know what, we have control. We can do this because we have the potential for generating real wealth because we have access to land. And it was made very clear in the beginning that this was going to be about not only redeveloping the community, but it's going to be about generating wealth. We want to show, and again, talking about turning conventional planning on its head, it had seemed to be that the conventional wisdom says you can't have development or redevelopment without the inevitable displacement of people, because the land values will go up and people can't, you know, all that. And it was part and parcel of the conventional thinking. And they threw conventional thinking out the door. They said one way to prevent that is that we have to, one, and this is very interesting, when they got the power of eminent domain, very sophisticated thinking here, and they said we are going to put the land under a community land trust, control of community land trust. The homes that are built on the land and the businesses that are built on that will belong to the individuals, but the land will belong to the community. And there was a reason for that, because there was a fear that if they built these beautiful new homes, these are affordable homes, that a developer or a speculator could come in and buy up these homes that because they were made affordable, mind you, and then resell them at, you know, by hiking up the prices, and then and create the displacement by making huge profits on these what should have been affordable homes. The land trust had a restriction on the profit that could be derived from the resale of these homes over the first 10 years. 0.5% a year for 10 years. What that did was it discouraged developers from coming in and buying these up and speculating. But it also initially discouraged the banks from issuing mortgages. They said, you're never going to sell these homes. Homes are an investment. How are you going to get people to buy a home that they can't resell and make a huge profit on? And the community said, because we're looking for people who don't want to necessarily make that, we're looking for people who want to live here. And you know what? They found the people who wanted to live here. Many of those people were the people who had been displaced as a result of the arson for profit. So that was key. And the other key point was a real component of home ownership. Can we make these homes? There were some rentals and there were some co-ops, but one of the keys was to provide the opportunity for the residents of Roxbury to own an important asset and to start to accumulate and build their own personal wealth. And that, for many people, is your home. And so that was, and so you become part of the gentrified community as opposed to a victim of the gentrified community. So the organizing around those principles and empowering, and I think that's the key, empowering the residents with the ability to have control over their own fate was the greatest organizing tool that we had. Mm-hmm. And it worked. Yeah. It worked.
Yeah, well, I can see where it would, because people feel just the opposite, disempowered, and like things don't belong to them. Certainly the land doesn't belong to them. Where they live doesn't belong to them. So why not trash it,
right,
oftentimes? So and what was your role in this, Greg Watson?
Well, for 4 years, I served as the executive director. Now, this was a resident-led organization, and I mean that in the truest sense of the word. The 30-member board was, as I mentioned, elected, community election every 2 years. And these were this was a very involved board, not a rubber stamp board. And it's interesting. Let me just pause for a second and just mention that everyone involved in this knew that this was going to be a long process. And most of them had the perspective, we know that we're doing this for our children and our grandchildren. It's been almost 18 years now that the program has been in place. And certainly urban renewal could have been done probably in 5 years, but they would not have been a part of that. So, very strong community-led organization that hired a professional staff to come on board. And I was hired as executive director and served in that position for 4 years.
Mm-hmm. And what else is sustainable about it? I mean, obviously it's sustainable for people to have their own affordable houses, and the land trust thing. I've heard many times about the advantages of land trust, but we won't spend too much time on that.
But I think it's a lot of it had to do, too, with the vision of economic development. I mean, because, again, it's sort of interesting. People understood the housing piece, and the housing piece was pretty straightforward. I mean, it's not easy, but since you had access to the land, you could assemble the land, you could then invite developers to come in. And anyway, so you got the homes built. But then the question of economic development came up, and there was a lot of advice we got from professionals that said, the only way you're going to achieve any kind of economic development is use your power of eminent domain. You've got the land. Offer up some of that land for free to some big company or corporation to come in as an anchor and spearhead your economic development. And they said no.
Economic development basically means creating jobs.
Creating jobs. And what the folks at Dudley at least realized was that the economic development had more to do with creating a sense of place, a sense of security, and creating sort of a quality of life, which I think is very important. And let me just give you an example. The residents were a little concerned. They said, but we don't know anything about economic development. How can we plan for our own economic development? We undertook an exercise, and it was a scenario planning or a planning process, and we asked everybody to close, 50 people were in the room, asked them to close their eyes, envision that they were sitting on Dudley Street, summer evening, 9 o'clock on a park bench, which didn't exist at that point on our streets, but nonetheless envision that, and all we said was, and now you feel perfectly safe. Now open your eyes and tell us what you see. And people started to talk and said, well, 9 o'clock at night, I feel safe. That must mean that there are people on the street, because I'm safe. And it's 9 o'clock at night, so they must be coming from someplace, or coming from restaurants, or coming from theaters, or coming from clubs. And we started to talk about that, and that started to generate this scenario about what kinds of activities you wanted your economic development to generate to create a sense of place, a sense of security. And then, but most importantly, we said it would be a place that would be exciting and vibrant and unique, and it would celebrate the cultural diversity that a lot of people would see as being divisive, because we couldn't agree. could be an economic strength, because you could have Cape Verdean restaurants, you could have Latino restaurants and soul food restaurants from African Americans, and then clubs. So the sustainable part says that we wanted an economic strategy that was diverse, that celebrated the cultural diversity, but that wasn't overly dependent upon some outside source coming in, being our, quote, savior or anchor, and then having no commitment or investment in the community, and when a better offer or better location came up, would have no qualms about packing up and leaving, and leaving the place devastated. So the sustainability came in sort of making sure that this was grounded in the local folks, and that local ownership was going to be a major part. There was also a big part about making sure that whatever activities were encouraged, particularly economic activities, that they were environmentally sound, that they weren't going to create the kinds of problems that we were trying to overcome as a result of the illegal dumping of, you know, toxic waste. I don't know if I mentioned there were 51 hazardous waste sites in that community. 51 hazardous waste sites. 40% of the trash transfer stations or dumps in Boston were located within the neighborhood boundaries of Roxbury. You know, again, that's so the question was, let's clean it up. Let's encourage the kinds of activities that were also environmentally sound. And I think that's part of the sustainability strategy for the neighborhood.
Such as
promoting urban agriculture, food production, a program called the Food Project, which was originally created by a group out of one of the suburbs, Lexington, Massachusetts, to introduce young people to food production, was established in the community. And for the first year or so, the organizers of the Food Project would take kids from the Roxbury neighborhood out to the farm, Drumlin Farm in Lexington. But then they came back one year and said, wait a minute, there's a lot of land here in Roxbury. Couldn't we grow the food right here rather than transporting folks out to Lexington? And went to the community and found excitement there and support for it. A half acre was devoted, and then later on another 1.5 acres was devoted to urban agriculture. So we got about 2 acres in food production. But here's the other part and that's outside. Now, obviously, traditional agriculture, short growing season. Then the idea came up, could we extend the growing season with a greenhouse? We got an opportunity to get some funds from the Environmental Protection Agency as part of one of its sort of environmental cleanup programs. And there was an abandoned garage, a commercial garage, leaking oil, gas, brownfield. We got money to clean up that garage, and actually about $750,000 from the EPA for this project. When the community was asked what they wanted to rebuild and reestablish on that site, it was a 10,000-square-foot greenhouse. Hasn't been built yet, but the plans are there. The site's been cleaned up. The resources have been acquired. The plans have been sort of pulled together. So, again, there's just exciting, a whole different way of thinking about an urban, particularly a low-income urban community. Open space, yes, parks, but now food, and reestablishing the Roxbury Russet apple tree, which was originally, you know, grown in there. So the history of the place, it's all coming together as a unique, exciting, vibrant urban village.
Well, when you say it's a different way of thinking, that's really so important, because every situation is different, and we know ways that are better. At least I think that there's plenty of books and knowledgeable people who know how to do things in ways that doesn't damage the environment. It's so important to grow food where you are, because then you don't have to, like, use energy to transport it all this way and all more oil, and it also involves people getting closer to the earth and on and on. I could talk on and on, but the main point is that once people have that mindset, then you relate to each other and the place, ideally, in a way that's just going to create a different kind of reality.
And you empower people to say, you know what, we can do other things now as well. And, you know, and let's become more engaged, and let's not settle on what people tell us, you know, what we can do. More importantly, what our limitations are. And that really has been the name of the game. I mean, they've been told over and over again what you can't do, what you're not capable of doing. And by really achieving this and flying in the face of traditional wisdom or conventional wisdom, I think you've got a community and an example of how you can do even more and even greater things, as great as this accomplishment has been. Mm-hmm. And that's the real, I think, long-lasting impact.
Right. Are there any other things about that community? I mean, there's a lot of other things we could talk about, but we don't have too much time. Well, we have a little bit of time. So are there any other things you'd like to share about that community that are unusual?
Well, it's not unusual here, but if you really wanted to say how successful is this, you know, we can talk about the number of homes. We can talk about the number of lots that have been cleaned up. A third of the abandoned properties have been reestablished, and that's important. But here, to me, is the real key, the youth. The youth have become very involved in this, and I'm really sort of happy to say that when it was time, when I decided to take on this new role as the, you know, as Renewable Energy Trust Fund and relinquish the executive directorship of Dudley Street, I was really wary and didn't want to do it. But then what happened was John Barrows, a young man who, when he was 15 years of age, got up and became the first youth to run for the board of directors of the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative. Cape Verdean young man. And he says, there are no youth on our board. He was elected to the board of directors at 15, went off to college, graduated from Dartmouth College with high honors, came back to the community. Worked in Boston for a while at the big insurance firm, was making and doing very well. But when it came time for me to leave, he came to me and says, Greg, I want to give back to the community. Do you think I have a shot at becoming executive director of the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative? And I said, John, I think you've got an excellent shot. And he did, and he is now executive director of DS&I. And we're finding more and more youth who do go off and go to college, they come back and they want to be a part of what their parents and their grandparents have worked so hard to create for them. That, to me, is the greatest sign that it's the right thing and it's successful.
Totally. Well, it's definitely moving me. I seem to be getting a little teary here. That it's totally, totally wonderful.
Before closing, just like to mention two pieces. There's a book called Streets of Hope by Holly Sklar and Peter Medoff that documents the history of the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative, and an award-winning video called Holding Ground that's also available. Website, www.dsni, for Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative.org. You can get all the information on those two.
DSNI.org.
That's correct.
And this is amazing that Massachusetts has a renewable energy trust. I said that in the beginning. We don't really have too much time to talk about it, but that you could say like a sentence.
Well, here's what they should know is that that our state legislature has committed $150 million to create the infrastructure to promote the increased production and use of renewable energy in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, supported by ratepayers, but long-term commitment for a clean energy future.
Oh, that is totally wonderful. And you, Greg Watson, are the head of the program director for that. So I really appreciate your time today, and thank you very much for this interview, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Sue. Appreciate the time.
My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.